issue of whether to apply presumptive sentencing to first felon was probably the most debated issue of the sentencing provisions. The commission, the criminal code subcommission, made an initial determination that as to first-time offenders in the felony class, you would not have presumptive sentencing. The judge would have total discretion as to sentences. However, for second and third offenders, there is a system of presumptive sentencing. Now, what this does here is we have A, B, and C felonies. It's important to note that presumptive sentencing does not apply to misdemeanors. Misdemeanors are governed exactly as they are today. If it's an A misdemeanor, it's 0 to 1 year. If it's a B misdemeanor, it's 0 to 90 days, regardless of whether it's your second offense. So for your first offenses, you have maximum terms of imprisonment. For A felony, it's 22 and a half years. I should point out that until, I think, the second or third day before the bill was sent to the floor, the discovery used to be 15, was raised to 22 and a half. But for the first A felony, it's 22 and a half. For a first B felony, it's 7. For a first C felony, it's 3. And again, the judge doesn't have to give that, but if he is going to give jail time, it cannot exceed that maximum. Probation is available, suspended imposition of sentence is available. If you're a first-time felon offender, you will also be eligible for parole and under the existing system. Now, when you're dealing for a second offender, you have presumptive sentencing, and the important thing is to determine what is a second offender. Under the commission's proposal, in order to be a second offender, you would have had to previously be convicted of the same or higher class of crime. So, if you are now being sentenced for a B felony, and your previous offense was a C felony, you would not be a second offender. Now, that was under the commission's proposal. Now, this was changed by House Judiciary Committee. What House Judiciary Committee said is that any previous felony would get you into the felony second offender category. So let's assume we're dealing here with a guy with an offender who had a C felony and now he's being sentenced for an A. His presumptive sentence is 10 years. That would also apply if he had previously been convicted of an A felony. There's no distinction between the two. Now, that 10-year sentence could be aggravated 50%, which would go to 15 or mitigated to 5. And then here are the numbers for second B's, 5, 2, third would be 15, 10, 4. And again, the 50% factor would apply to the second and third. Okay. Now, the only exception to this scheme are the unclassified crimes and the firearm provision for A felonies. For murder in the first degree, the sentence has to be 20 to 99 years, and the 20-year sentence is the maximum, is a mandatory minimum sentence that must be served. For murder in the second degree or kidnapping, there's a 5 to 99-year sentence. Again, the 5-year sentence is a mandatory minimum sentence. And then, this is something that came also fairly late in the game. The House Judiciary Committee added a provision which said that if you are being sentenced as a first-time A felon, and again, we're talking about crimes like rape, armed robbery, aggravated assault, and you had committed the offense with a firearm, you must be sentenced to a 3-year minimum sentence. So that is the only, these provisions are really the only mandatory minimum sentences in the bill. And again, summary, no parole for second and third offenders, and also no probation or SIS for second and third. Good time is 1 to 3. And that's 20 minutes.
Well done, Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
With the exception of the last sheet, I'm wondering if Barry could lend that to Debbie or whoever for a couple of days to prepare an informal index so that we can have section and page number and titles from in our folders. We're going to be into this thing hot and heavy for the next couple of weeks at least. And if you could just pat us out an index as to what he's just been covering based upon that chart, that would be a big help if we all had one, because we can go to page to page and section to section for course references and everything else.
If you could just type off the
Yeah, off the first couple of, the first, all the pages but the last.
When you wanted to, it doesn't break it down in terms of the specific crime.
No, just what you've got, just your basic outline, because when you're guiding us through this thing, you can say, now here we're on page 42, but you should check this out against page 76 and this other for correlation purposes. It'd make it a lot easier for it.
Tell me what you're working on now.
I'm working off the bill that passed the House.
We can get the House.
No, I know that. Okay. My question is really asking you. You're compiling some information about that.
I'm sorry.
What was the suggestion, Doug?
Oh, the policy changes.
I suggested a very well demo that laid out very succinctly all the policies.
I thought if your schedule is to just go to the specific sections of the code, I thought instead of giving you one major one, I would do separate one for each day you take up a section. For example, if you did offense against a person, I hope to give you a handout a few days before that. Before the meeting, as opposed to just a general one, but I could probably run them all off of this.
Have you seen within recent days a letter written by Andrew Klein from the Tampa Bay Valley Bar Association?
No, I haven't.
Drop by my office tomorrow. Let me run a coffee. That's real hard criticism. Would you raise some interesting points?
Senator, I'm not certain that she's on this, but in terms of the index. Are we working with the committee substitute that passed the House?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Okay, your needle wiggles? Okay. I'll call the meeting to order. It's Senate Judiciary, April the 25th, present for the purpose of quorum. Our Senators Ziegler, Tillian, and Holman. Barry, are you ready to?
Okay.
State your name and proceed.
For the record, my name is Barry Stern. I'm with the staff counsel for the Criminal Code Subcommittee. I prepared two handouts that should be in your folders. One is just basically an index to the code. The other is entitled Senate Judiciary Committee Meeting 42578. And outlines the major policy changes in the revised code with existing law. What I would like to do is use the chart again and go through the crimes against the person today. This is chapter 41 of the bill. And that begins, I believe, on
page 6.
The homicide article is the first article of chapter 41, and there are four crimes contained in that section. We have 2 degrees of murder, we have manslaughter, and we have criminally negligent homicide. Now, just for some background, the original proposal by the subcommission only had 1 degree of murder, and it was defined to include conduct described in murder in the first and murder in the second degree. So the House Judiciary Committee felt that we should have 2 degrees, and we did create 2 degrees in House Judiciary. Murder in the first degree is defined as an intentional killing, and that is the only type of conduct covered within that statute. I pointed out on that list of policy changes that there's no requirement that the killing be done with deliberate premeditated malice. Just solely an intentional killing would be first-degree murder. Second-degree murder
first degree murder, by the way, carries a 20 to 99 year sentence. The 20 year sentence is a minimum sentence that has to be given.
Are we free to interrupt Barry from time to time if a question occurs? Do you object to that?
No, I don't.
In other words, the split second reaction to picking up of a rifle and shooting would be first degree murder.
That is correct. That is correct. There has to be a conscious objective to cause death. I would also think that under existing law, as long as there would be some time to think about it, even though it was a split second thought, it would possibly still be first degree murder.
You know, it's kind of distinguished from blinding, way pushwagging, or ambushing somebody.
Okay. The problem with the existing formulation of premeditated malice, it really doesn't require lying in wait. If it did, it may have a valid distinction, but it doesn't. So first degree murder is the intentional killing, and it's a 20-year minimum sentence, then it goes as high as 99 years. Now, second degree is three forms of conduct. The first is intent to cause serious physical injury, or knowing that your conduct is substantially stirring to cause death or serious physical injury to cause death. That's just a shade below first-degree murder, and it's questionable if that's really an appropriate distinction between the two. But I think that it is to some extent. To the point that it includes intent to cause serious physical injury as necessary a culpable mental state for murder, that would expand existing law. Under existing law, if you just merely intended to cause serious physical injury and death resulted, you'd probably be guilty of manslaughter at the most. Subsection A2 covers conduct which I like to refer to as depraved heart murder. That's conduct where you don't necessarily intend to kill, but your act was so reckless that it deserves the punishment provided for under the murder statute. And that is defined as intentionally performing an act resulting in death under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to value in life. Now, the kind of conduct that would be covered by that is perhaps throwing rocks off a building into a crowded street, or racing your motorboat through some swimmers. It's hard to say whether that conduct is covered under murder in either degree under existing law. There's one in the policy discussion I handed out. There's one statute called obstructing or injuring railroad or aircraft, which says that if you basically put an obstruction in front of a railroad and someone dies, even though you didn't intend to cause death, you're guilty of first degree murder. Sure. Now, this would apply to all acts that are that type of conduct, regardless of whether it was a steamship or a ferry. Now, subsection A3 is felony murder. And that is also new to existing law. Felony murder rule would hold a felon liable for basically all deaths occurring during certain violent felonies. And we have a very limited felony murder rule under existing law, and essentially we don't have any, according to the Supreme Court's interpretation of Gray. Now, murder in the second degree carries a 5 to 99 year sentence, 5 years being mandatory. The next section in the code sets out the defenses to murder. First one is the defense heat of passion, and that applies to the intentional killing, and that is set out on page 7 of the bill. And that's basically your common law defense heat of passion, and what it does, it says if you kill in a heat of passion and fall within the description of what a heat of passion is, it won't be murder, it'll be manslaughter. That's just the law. The second defense says that if you aid a suicide, it is not murder, it's going to be manslaughter. And that's similar to existing law. It's called, existing law is a separate statute called procuring a suicide. The important thing to note, however, is that this refers to aiding a suicide. For example, someone, your wife may tell you to go out and buy some poison so she suicide. If you, for example, are requested to pull a trigger so the person can die, that's not seen as suicide in the code, although it's not specifically specified. That would be first degree murder. Subsection B1 and B2 apply simply to felony murder. And there are two very limited defenses to felony murder. The first one in subsection B1 is, just for purposes of the discussion, I call the good felon defense. And that deals with the situation where the person that is committing the felony isn't armed with a deadly weapon or a dangerous instrument. He doesn't have any reason to believe that anyone else is armed. And he had no reasonable ground to believe that anyone was going to engage in conduct where death was likely to result. The kind of conduct that would be covered by that is a situation where a person goes into to hold up a grocery store, and he's not armed with a deadly weapon, he doesn't produce a deadly weapon, doesn't make representations that the deadly weapon is there. A guard shoots at the felon, and misses the felon, kills the bystander. This provision says that the felon is not guilty of felony murder. He could be charged with something else. He could be charged perhaps with manslaughter, but it's not felony murder. It's a very limited defense.
But if he's armed,
he has a firearm. That's correct. If he's armed with a dangerous instrument, he is going to be guilty of felony murder because he would not meet the requirement to be. Okay. Now, subsection 2 is really a very difficult provision to explain, and just speaking with Mr. Hickey beforehand, it might need some regraphing to make it clearer. This provision deals with the situation, well, let me backtrack. One of the crimes that is sufficient for felony murder is burglary in the first degree. Burglary in the first degree is part of defined as burglary into a dwelling. Now, consider the situation where a person intends to kill someone, and in order to accomplish that task, he has to unlawfully enter a building, unlawfully enter the dwelling. This simply says that if that is that type of situation, you shouldn't be charged with felony murder. You should be charged with intentional killing, with intentional murder, or knowing murder, just not felony murder. It's a very limited defense, and it's basically telling the prosecutor in that type of situation, don't charge with felony murder, charge with intentional murder. Subsection C deals with the situation where the person may have acted based on some justification, but it turned out that his belief was unreasonable. For example, under the code, if you kill someone in self-defense and the jury finds you that it's a reasonable belief that it was necessary to do that, you won't be guilty of any crime. This provision says if you kill someone in self-defense and it's an unreasonable belief, but it's an honest belief nonetheless, you would not be guilty of murder, you would be guilty of manslaughter. This would also apply, for example, to the police officer who is making an arrest and he unreasonably believes he may use deadly force. Turns out that he could not, but he honestly believed that. This says you're not guilty of murder, you're guilty of manslaughter. This would be similar to existing law too. Now, the next crime is manslaughter. And manslaughter is defined as the intentional, knowing, or reckless killing not amounting to murder. What this really covers is killings in the heat of passion, an unreasonable belief as justification, aiding a suicide, and also reckless killing. And that's similar to our existing manslaughter statute. The final crime in the homicide section is criminally negligent homicide. And on that policy sheet, I pointed out that this is new to existing law, and I put a question mark next to it. I say it really isn't, but most everyone else I've spoken to says that it is. So let's assume that it is new to existing law. Now, what this requires, criminally negligent homicide, is a criminally negligently causing death. And the term criminal negligence is defined on page 94. That definition basically requires that the person criminal negligence in terms of causing death
is defined as a person failing to perceive a substantial and unjustifiable risk that death will occur. And the risk must be such a nature and degree that failure to perceive it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. First of all, this is not ordinary negligence. It has to be a gross deviation, and it has to be of such a nature and degree that failure to perceive it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe. And the commentary stresses it's not ordinary negligence, but deals with a situation where you should have been aware of a risk of death, and you weren't, and was extremely culpable. And under the code, the jury finds that he did act criminally negligently, and death resulted. It would be a seat dominant.
Where's that definition for you?
First yeah, I'm sorry, that's on page 94. Line 28. See, it's probably good to emphasize the distinction between recklessly and criminal negligence. In the code, we have four terms that we use to denote culpability: intentional, knowing, reckless, and criminal negligence. Now, recklessness is defined as awareness and disregard of the risk. So for your manslaughter case, the person would be aware of the risk of death and then disregard it. For criminal negligence, he wouldn't be aware of the risk, and he disregarded it unconsciously.
But he should have been aware.
He should have been aware. That's correct. And most, I believe every revised code which I've consulted does recognize the concept of criminal negligence as a sufficient culpability standard for homicides and certain assaults. But outside of the homicide and assault area, I think we only use the term criminal negligence in one other statute, the lowest form of culpability. That's homicide.
Questions on this?
No, I don't. I have no trouble with what you're going so far.
Okay. I'll try to point out before I begin each section the changes from the original draft. When we came in from the subcommission to the House Judiciary Committee, we had four degrees of assault, plus the crime of reckless endangerment, plus the crime of simple assault. It was felt that that was just too much, that we tried differentiating assaults, went a little too far. So what we ended up doing in the House Judiciary was that we compressed four degrees of assault into three, and the crime of simple assault was totally eliminated from the assault sections and treated as harassment, which we'll come to, I think, tomorrow. Now, there are three factors that distinguish the various forms of assault in the code. The first is the culpability of the defendant. And what that basically says is that the person that acts intentionally is going to be held guilty of a higher crime, usually, than the person that acted recklessly or with criminal negligence. The second way the assaults are distinguished is in terms of the type of injury that is inflicted. And we distinguish between two types: physical injury and serious physical injury. Assaults that produce serious physical injury are generally treated more seriously than assaults that produce physical injury or assaults that merely place a person in fear of injury. The final way we distinguish between the assaults is the type of, I'm sorry, was whether a weapon was used in committing the offense. And generally, if a weapon was used, it can be treated as a more serious form of assault. Assault in the first degree is a felony, and it describes three forms of conduct. The first is similar to the assault with a dangerous weapon statute, and it provides that when you cause physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument, intending to cause serious physical injury, you're guilty of the first degree assault, which is an a felony. Now, the term serious physical injury, and dangerous instrument are all defined in the definition section of the bill. Serious physical injury is defined on page 101, and it's physical injury which creates a substantial risk of death
protracted term of hell or protracted term as a function of a bodily organ or physical injury, which unlawfully terminates a pregnancy. Physical injury is just defined as physical pain or impairment of physical condition. A dangerous instrument is defined as anything which under the circumstances used, attempts to be used, threatened to be used, is capable of causing death or serious physical injury. So, you know, this coffee cup could be a dangerous instrument if I picked it up and started hitting someone over the head with it. The definition of dangerous instrument specifically includes firearms, and firearms are defined to include loaded as well as unloaded firearms. Subsection 8.2 is similar to the mayhem statute in existing law, and it prohibits the conduct of causing serious physical injury when you acted with the intent of causing such injury. So, defined as intent to cause serious physical injury, you cause physical injury. Subsection 8.3 is similar to that provision of the murder in the second degree statute, which I refer to as depraved heart murder. This says that if you intentionally performing an act that causes serious physical injury under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, you're guilty of a felony. So under the code, if you throw the rock off the building and someone dies, you're going to be guilty of second degree murder. If someone doesn't die but he's seriously injured, you're going to be guilty of assault in the first degree, which is done to be a felony. Assault in the second degree is defined in three subsections. The first is defined as with intent to cause physical injury, you cause serious physical injury. The second is intentionally placing a person in fear of imminent serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument. Now, that doesn't require that any injury occur. It simply requires placing the person in fear. And because dangerous instrument is defined as including firearms that are loaded as well as unloaded, merely pointing an unloaded firearm at someone would be assault in the second degree. So when you're dealing with your firearm type of assaults, you're going to either charge under subsection A1 of the first degree section if there is some type of injury, or you're going to charge under subsection A2 if there's no injury, if once you prove an intent to place the person in fear of imminent serious physical injury. Subsection A3 is defined as recklessly causing physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument. That might be the situation where you swing a club around over your head and it just goes flying off and it knocks someone out. That's defined as a speed felony. And again, the definition of reckless requires a gross deviation from the standard of cure. So it's fairly serious conduct. So those are the first two degrees of assault, and they're both felonies. Assault in the third degree is your basic form of assault in the code. It's defined intentionally or recklessly causing physical injury or causing physical injury by a dangerous instrument if you acted with criminal negligence or placing a person in fear of imminent physical injury. And this section, B3, is the lesser included of subsection A2, in the sense that if you place a person in fear of imminent serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument, it's a DSP felony. If you didn't use a dangerous instrument, if you just simply use your hands or by words, you may be guilty of any misdemeanor.
Verbal assault?
That is correct. I believe it's defined as by words or conduct.
That's what it says.
Yes.
Well, I mean, suppose somebody says, and it looks as if he means to do it, you say, well, bitch, I'm going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You mean you can be prosecuted?
Well, I should point out
that you would be buried if I'm
not. I think it requires that you be frightened by that. If you're not frightened,
yes,
then he's clear.
And
that's happened every three times today. Oh, my God, I've been scared every time.
Does this apply to carcasses?
There's a special exemption for conduct during the session. Actually, Senator Ziegler, the way the statute was drafted previously on page 10, line 14, It said, by word or conduct, he intentionally places or attempts to place, and would cover unsuccessful attempts. And House Judiciary thought that was just too broad, and we just simply kept the requirement that you actually succeed in doing it. And I think the limitation to imminent physical injury, I think, may go a fair amount to make the statute not as broad as it could be. We didn't have the imminence in there.
Two variables, right? Whether he intentionally places, intentional, and fear, right? The guy's not frightened by it. Or he could always, his defense is, well, he doesn't mean to do it. Right?
Well,
he didn't really mean to do it.
Yeah, well, under intentionally, the definition of intentionally, you would have to prove that it was his conscious objective to place the person in fear. And that's going to be, you're never going to be able to prove that by pointing to specific facts. It's going to always have to be circumstantial. And it's going to be, I think, a fairly serious case before you charge someone with that exception. The final crime in this article is called reckless endangerment. And this is new to existing law. Reckless endangerment covers the conduct of recklessly engaging in conduct which creates substantial risk of serious physical injury to another person. Important thing to note about this statute is, number one, there doesn't have to be any injury to anyone. You didn't have to intend to cause injury. Simply creating a substantial risk of serious physical injury to another person. One example that the person just recently gave me about conduct which would be covered under this was, apparently a few years in Juneau, someone walked into the Baranoff, and I'm sorry, not the Baranoff, the Red Dog, and pulled out a chainsaw and started swinging it every which way. And I think that under this statute, you could say that he engaged in conduct which created a substantial risk of serious physical injury to another person. Under existing law, we have statutes on careless use of firearms. We have on negligent and reckless driving, which cover this kind of conduct as those specific types of conduct. This is a general provision and would apply to all forms of conduct that fit within the definition. It's a fairly typical provision in revised criminal codes, and I know particularly people in the field of law enforcement think it's a fairly decent one. I'm going to just have to take a little break.
What page are we on now?
Dan knows the 65 in the code. An A misdemeanor is up to a year. A B misdemeanor is up to what, 30 days?
90 days.
90 days.
Should I move on to kidnap?
What's the 90 days? Tell me again now.
A misdemeanor would have a maximum sentence of 1 year. B misdemeanor would have a maximum sentence of 90 days. And those, all misdemeanors, are totally within the judge's discretion. No presumptive,
no mandatory sentencing at all.
That's right.
About that, a couple of little things I want to share.
The guy that walked into the Red Dog the other night hit the waitress. Where would he fall in this?
Was he married to her? We can't
okay. First of all, was he armed with a gun or
no? Just hit her.
Just hit her. That would be under the A misdemeanor offense. Unintentionally causes physical injury to another person under A1. 110. Yeah, A1.
Okay. And he could get that up to a year, right?
That's correct. Under existing law, it would only be a maximum of 6 months under the general assault statute.
Under existing law, somebody has to press charges?
Under existing law, and I think under both of
these
laws,
too. This one, too, you have to press charges. If you let somebody pound on you, it's legal.
Without a complaint or an indictment, there is no problem.
You're talking about a misdemeanor.
And the person who's injured, it's under existing law, it's required that person file charges.
Well, I think Dan could probably answer this a little better, but the thing is if it's a misdemeanor assault, there's a requirement that in order to make an arrest, it can take place within the presence of the officer. So that might go to the reason why you need someone to file charges, but Dan could probably answer that.
There's a difference between proceeding with an arrest and proceeding with filing a charge in court, accusing someone of doing something. In order to arrest an individual for a misdemeanor offense, a police officer has to have observed the offense himself or have a third party make a citizen's arrest, with the exception of en banc under present law. Under the proposed code, there's a proposal to allow for probable cause arrest not committed in the presence of the arresting officer in domestic situations, assault on the spouse. In order to file charges, all I would have is a report that provided me with evidence of defense. Whether the person who was the victim technically wanted to go forward with the case or not would be irrelevant. If I made a determination that the public interest was such that the case should go forward and the person should be forced to testify who was the victim, then technically the defendant could still be prosecuted.
Okay, now that the person that suffers the injury, she's a waitress, does she have to...
The policeman heard about it, he could just press charges.
In other words, if someone called the police and the police officer came and she said, yes, he assaulted me, the red dog came in and punched me in the mouth, but I don't want to sign a citizen's arrest, then the police officer could arrest him. But he could take statements from everybody who was a witness, and then he could bring a report to one of my offices, and it would describe what occurred, who observed what. On that basis, I could file a charge accusing the defendant of having hit that woman in the mouth. Now, the woman may subsequently come forward and say, gee, I really don't want to go forward with this. I don't want to testify to this person. I'd like to drop it. And you may or may not.
Is the guy walking the streets while all this is happening?
It would be until I filed a charge and got into a summons or a warrant. I could file a charge and ask the judge for a warrant, in which case the police officer could go arrest him.
Well, we're talking about it some time, though, right?
Sure.
Then they are. Bail at them.
Yeah, he'd be right out on bail on misdemeanor, something like that. There isn't any way to do it unless he's criminally dangerous, like if he was drunk, waiting, threatening somebody else, then I guess you could lock him up. But otherwise,
who was the waitress? The line? Oh, no kidding. Yeah, she quit. Right? Didn't want to have anything to do with that kind of business anymore after that. I can't blame her. But it seems to me that Claire was there, and the officer said that. I don't know if she didn't, if it was because she didn't see the actual blow being delivered or what, but she couldn't, they wouldn't arrest it. And I understand that
quite often the person hit doesn't see it coming.